Strategic Christian Services is pleased to present Megatrends and the Nature of the Gospel. This is Session 4 with Dr. Carl Ellis.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I've enjoyed this conference. I've gained so much. I've been joking with people all around for the last couple of days that everybody's been stealing my thunder. All the things I had planned to say have already been pretty much said. But, well, we're going to try to glean some stuff. And then I was told, I was encouraged by a sister. She said, well, everybody says some of the things from different perspectives. And maybe your perspective might sink in, whereas somebody else's may not. Okay, well, let me start off by just sharing with you a story that's often told about a hen and a pig. They were both walking down the street and having this wonderful conversation about worldview, you know. So they passed this coffee shop, and they heard the chef holler out, "We have an emergency, we have no bacon or eggs." And so the hen said, "Hey," he said to the pig, he says, "We have servants' hearts, why don't we go, look, I can supply eggs and you can supply bacon, why don't we go help those guys out?" So the pig said, "No, I don't think that's a good idea." He said, "No, no, come on, man. Where's your charity, man? Where's your sense of servanthood?" He said, listen. For you, you know, as a hen, it's involvement. But for me, it's commitment." Okay? And so a lot of times I find myself in that same situation. Whereas the pig really wanted to help the chef, you know, at the coffee shop. But obviously, it involved a little bit more for him. Now, I say that because I'll just say that I agree with everything that's been said here, all right? You know, everything. But strictly from an African-American perspective, when I talk about, you know, I studied under Francis Schaeffer for a while, and he used to talk about, you know, if you knew Schaeffer, you know, he said, "The loss of the Christian consensus," you know how he used to do. And I say, doc, I say, "But you don't understand." He says, "Well, we need to return to the Northern European Reformation culture." I said, "Doc, I can't return to the Northern European Reformation culture. I was never there." He said, oh, I forgot about that. And while what he says is absolutely true, that you can go and talk to the man in the streets, you know, say 100 years ago, everybody pretty much knew what the gospel was. And today, very few people do. We have lost the Christian consensus. And in a sense, that's a very, very sad thing. But from my point of view, looking at it strictly ethnically, I say to the Christian consensus, good riddance. Why? Because during the days of the Christian consensus, see, folks like me were having a hard time, you know? You know, if you're in the South and you kind of look somebody in the eye, you were swinging from a tree within 12 hours. You know what I'm saying? And I couldn't drink at the water fountain. I couldn't stay. You understand what I'm saying? So the world today, and all of its secular, humanistic, anti-Christian, whatever, it's more Christian for me than it was back then. And I say that as to illustrate what's going on with the resurgence of Islam. Same kind of thing. What we suffered in this country is very, very much related to what those folks what they suffered in colonialism, in terms of identity. Now, you say, well, the colonialists, you know, they brought infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. Yes, they did do all of that. But what folks don't realize is that people need also identity. Yeah. Right. And need a sense of who they are. Right. And if you leave that out of the equation, I don't care how much infrastructure you bring, it's going to be a terrible thing. I know I used to work with Chuck Colson years ago, and I used to go into these different prisons and do these seminars. You know, and I've been to all the country club prisons, by the way. I've been to the holes, too, you know. But I go to these country club prisons, and I discovered that there is no such a thing. Oh, I've been to prisons with swimming pools and golf courses. But, you know, that's not a country club. It's a prison. And they might have wonderful facilities, but if you don't have your freedom, you ain't got nothing. I don't care how nice the place is. All right. So one of the things that we got to realize is that all things degenerate. All things degenerate. And this is one of the things somehow I don't see. We should have known this from the very beginning. If you look at the Bible talks about this. You look at Israel, you look at the people before the flood, you look at this, that, and the other. Everything degenerates. Everything. We all know that. So Christianity degenerates too. Christianity is subject to the same degenerative forces that everything else is subject to. And this is one of the reasons why we have a resurgence of Islam. Because we as Christians have somehow thought that we don't degenerate. We're sinners. We have not been saved from the decay and change. You know how in Revelations it says the universe stands on tiptoe, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We aren't glorified yet. And so what happens is when Christianity decays or degenerates, it tends to degenerate from Christianity to what I call Christianityism. Now, in Free at Last, I talk about, I have a fuller discussion of Christianityism. And just let me kind of give you a quick description of it. Christianity would be a valid, accurate application of the gospel of Jesus Christ in a particular cultural context. All right? Christianityism would be an expression of the cultural paganism in Christian language. Got it? All right. So Christianity always degenerates to, unless what? Acted upon by something else. Unless there is a reformation, unless there is a revival, unless there is a spiritual revolution, the degeneration will continue. And I agree completely that we are living in a day where we've gone beyond the need of revival. We do need another reformation. Now, let's talk about Christianityism. I'm just kind of giving you some preliminary things before we get to talking about Islam. And I'm not going to talk about Islam so much, but I'm going to talk about the challenge of Islam. All right? I'm going to talk about the challenge. If I got some time, I can talk. Y'all know about the five pillars and all that stuff, right? Okay. All right. If we got time, we'll get to that. All right? Now, when we talk about Christianityism, I make a distinction, a further distinction now. This is some of my latest stuff. There is absolute Christianityism. All right, something like the Ku Klux Klan would be an example of Christianityism in an absolute sense. All right, that's not so bad. I can handle that. But you know what's devastating? Relative Christianityism. Now, what I mean by relative Christianityism, it looks like Christianity from one cultural perspective, and it looks like Christianityism from another. And the reason that it looks like Christianityism from the other perspective is because of the toxic waste of the evangelical industrial complex that we put out there. We are very sloppy and haphazard and careless in the way we project our image and the way we communicate. Now, again, I'll use the African-American experience as my example here, but transfer that to Arabs, transfer that to Asians, transfer that to anybody you want. But from an African-American perspective, strictly an African-American perspective, not thinking as a Christian at this point, from an African-American perspective, American Christianity, the way it is practiced, looks like the white man's religion. We know it's not, but it looks like, you see, from the perspective of the Arabs, from the perspective of the Muslims, Christianity looks like Western, decadent, anti-Islamic, whatever. All right. Now, another thing that I think contributes to this is the appearance of Christianityism is when we take the gospel and we reduce it and present it as a full gospel. Got it? All right. Now, if the church fails to continually renew its prophetic voice in the culture, and that's what we're talking about here, having a prophetic voice in the culture, unless the church continually renews this prophetic voice, then relative Christianityism is the inevitable result. It will happen. And saints, I think that's what we have done. We have slipped into, we love Jesus, and we're going to go to heaven when we die, but we are certainly practicing some Christianityism in this country. And guess what? If left unchecked, absolute Christianityism will result. That's when you begin to confuse biblical norms with cultural norms. Christianityism of any stripe is totally unable to have a prophetic voice in the culture. American Christianity does not have much of a prophetic voice in this culture. Therefore, what? All right? We've got to clean up some toxic waste. We've got some toxic waste to clean up. And how do you find out about that? You go to the people who are the victims of the toxic waste. Well, they were in danger of going into Christianityism in the book of Acts. They had this nice little distribution system, right? And there was a kink in the system. You see? So what turned out to be a little foible in the system from a Hebrew perspective, remember, turned out to be commitment from a Greek perspective. You understand what I'm saying? So when we talk about the Christian consensus and the Christian culture and all that, but we didn't have the slavery thing together, and I'm sure Dennis would agree with this, that's true. But what you don't understand, for some of us, That's just not a problem. That's life and death. I'm in the position of the pig in this case. See. Now watch this. Watch this. The cultural evils we fail to address prophetically will come back to haunt us. There's a song by Oscar Brown Jr., or Oscar Brown Jr. sang it a number of years ago, called The Snake. Anybody remember that song? Okay. Now the story goes that this woman was coming home from work one day. It was a cold day. It was icy. And she saw the snake. And the snake was on the verge of death. And the snake says, "Take me in, tender woman. Take me in, for goodness sake. Take me in, tender woman," cried the snake. So she picked him up, brought him home, got him warm, put him by the fireplace. He wasn't quite revived by the next morning, but she went to work. She came home the next day and found that he was revived and looking good. She said, "Oh, you're beautiful." And so she hugged him. And the way the song goes, instead of saying thanks, the snake gave her a vicious bite. "I saved you," said the woman, "instead of walking by. You know your venom's poisonous, and now I'm going to die." "Oh, shut up, silly woman," said the reptile with a grin. "You knew darn well I was a snake before you took me in." And that's what happens with the stuff. Isn't that exactly what happened to Israel when they conquered the land of Canaan? God said, "Wipe out the Canaanites." They let the Canaanites slide. And instead of the Canaanites saying thanks, what do? They regain their strength and oppress the Israelites. That's precisely what has happened to us today. When the next generation writes the history books, the church will be tagged as having endorsed and sponsored these unaddressed cultural evils. The church didn't address the issue of slavery adequately. So what happens? When the next generation writes the history, they say the church endorsed slavery. That's what's going to happen. Now watch this. When movements arise to address these cultural issues, they will seek to destroy the perceived foundations of those cultural evils. And when the history books are written and they say the church sponsored all of this, what are they going to attack? They are going to attack Christian values. Satan wants to destroy Christianity. We know that. He wants to destroy the church. And the amazing thing is, when I look at the Bible, Satan never appears. I'm just trying to rack my brains. Can anybody think of one time where Satan appeared somewhere, other than to Jesus, where Satan appeared to someone as Satan? Now, Satan didn't have to be fooling around. You know, he just cut straight to the chase with Jesus. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, he did try the little disguise deal one time. Remember, he tried to hide behind Peter? Yeah. Jesus says, "Get out of here. You know, go to, well, you know." Satan always appears in disguise, right? And guess what? One of Satan's favorite hiding places is in legitimate movements against cultural evils. He has a hidden anti-Christian agenda. And he wants to get behind these movements, and these are legitimate movements. But somewhere along the line, he wants to strike out his venom. Now, if we're going to be prophetic, we must deny Satan hiding places by perpetually renewing our prophetic voice in the culture. We must force Satan to come out in the open as Satan if he wants to attack. And that seems to be our job. We must force Satan to reveal who he is. So those are just some preliminary comments that I wanted to make about some of the dynamics behind the resurgence of Islam and the turn to Islam by many Americans. You see, the growth of Islam in the United States is not, I repeat, not a measure of the strength of Islam. It is a measure of the weakness and retreat of the church. Now, before you think I'm going around here demonizing Muslims, I don't want to do that. I want you to know that I do not believe in demonizing Muslims, all right? There's a couple of truths that I want to... What is that? Oh, alhamdulillah. Okay. Okay. All right. But these are some things to remember. And no matter what I say about Muslims, I want you to know that these are some foundational things that I go by at all times. All right? First of all, Islam is a system. And Muslims are people. All right? Got it? Even if we despise the system, which I do, guess what? We must what? Love the people. Always remember that. I don't ever want you to think that I'm demonizing Muslims because I love Muslims, all right? It's the system that I can't stand. Because the system of Islam is a works righteousness system based on manipulation. Why do you think these guys blow themselves up in Israel, or fly planes into the World Trade Center. What's going on there? Here's the thing that amazes me. In Islam, there is no assurance of salvation. None. You never know how you stand with Allah. You never know. As a matter of fact, there's a fundamental doctrine in Islam called the doctrine of abrogation, which means that Allah can change his mind about anything at any time, and you can't do anything about it. He can call the truth a lie and a lie a truth, just like that. He could be having a bad hair day. You can live a perfect life and go to him and say, oh, I decided to switch it. Go to hell. Totally arbitrary, totally capricious. You never know, with one possible exception, if you die in a jihad, a holy war. You go straight to paradise. So here's some guys who realize the only way for them to have assurance of salvation is to die in a jihad. And so they declare a jihad, and they go in there, not as suicide bombers, but as martyrs. They blow themselves up. And here we as Christians, we sit on assurance of salvation, and we take it for granted and not for grace. Hallelujah. All right. Those are just some things that we got to understand where these guys are coming from, all right? There are some definite unanswered questions. You know, we have to get Christianity out from being perceived as a Western thing. It is not a Western thing. How can something Western be Western when it didn't even start in the West? Now, rather than going through a whole lot of different things about Islam and the five pillars and Muhammad and all that, if we have time, I can go through all of that. But rather than go through all that, I'm going to kind of shortcut because I need about 15 hours to do this thing right, all right, to tell you the truth, okay? Because I want to focus more on the challenge of Islam more than Islam itself, okay? Because you can always read about Islam. As a matter of fact, there's plenty of books on Islam. But we talk about two major characteristics of Islam in general. Ummah is a major characteristic of Islam. We got to understand that. Ummah. What is Ummah? Ummah is the binding sense of community. Now, all of us have that in one way or the other. In the African-American community, let me give you a nice Ebonics word for Ummah. Here's the Ebonics equivalent for Ummah. Are you ready? Mominem. Now, can anybody break that down for me? Mominem. Anybody understand that? Mama and them, see? But it's all one word. Mominem, right? So Mominem, that's the family. You know, that's, you know. Now, if you go back one generation, It's Big Mom and them. Okay. Okay. That is a very, very, very important thing to Muslims because you see, a lot of times I have had Muslims on the verge of becoming Christians, and the one thing that they could not get over, they could not come to Christ because of the Ummah. They felt that they would be in violation and betraying their community. See? That's one thing we in the West haven't, somehow we've forgotten about that. We're talking about the kingdom of God and stuff here, right? We've lost that in the West with our individualistic, right. You see? We've lost that. You see, if you're going to lead a Muslim to Christ, let's say, a Muslim from Saudi Arabia, all right? You lead him to Christ, you can't just give him the four spiritual laws and say, be blessed, you know? If you do that, his family might come after him to kill him. At least he'll be disowned. You know, you got to adopt him into your family. Your ummah has got to be his ummah. Right. You see, that's what Ruth understood. Right. Got it? Yes. And fortunately, Naomi had an ummah to go to. Yes. Ummah, the binding sense of community. That's one of the areas in which we need to have reformation, yes. Rediscovery of Christian community. And there it is, just like Dennis talks about that model. That, all right. And I'm telling you, that's going to be the most powerful tool that's going to crack Islam wide open. Unless we get that thing together, we ain't going to see it. So another characteristic of Islam is sunnah. Sunnah. What is sunnah? Sunnah is the adherence to the sayings and doings of Muhammad as the basis of community. If I were to give you the call, the prayer, Allahu Akbar, I just did it wrong. I didn't do it right. Okay. According to a Muslim who really understands, I didn't do it right. I got to say, Allahu Akbar. I got to do it that way. Why? Why do I have to sound so nasal? Because that's how Muhammad sounded. And if I'm going to do this thing right, I got to do it exactly the way he did. I brushed my hair to the side. Muhammad brushed his back. You know, I got to do it that way. He grew the beard and all that kind of stuff. Now, he had 9 wives, but as a Muslim, if I was a Muslim, I can only have 4. And the hadith says that Muhammad visited all 9 of his wives every morning before breakfast. Now, that's one of those things I couldn't quite, I don't know. Give me about a year to prepare psychologically, you know. But after that, just leave me alone for 6 months, you know. Hallelujah. But there are certain things. There's another source in Islam called the Hadith. The Hadith are the traditions of Muhammad that are not recorded in Quran, all right? Matter of fact, if you talk about Hadith, okay, there are different Hadith collections, you know. But when I say Hadith, just suffice it to say, anybody who knows about Islam, I'm talking about the Al-Bukhari Hadith. All Sunni Muslims accept that collection, all right? The Quran is about the size of the New Testament. Hadith is about the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So next time, when you get a whooping, get the Hadith, you know. Okay, all right. But these are the doings and sayings. These are the traditions and all that. Okay, now, I can go on to tell you how they sort out the good ones from the bad ones, but suffice it to say, that's it. So Islam, it's based on Sunnah, and a lot of Sunnah is derived from Islamic law. Islam is a religion of law. It is law. Law. Do's and don'ts. So it is said that a Muslim, there you go, is primarily derived from the Hadith. I already told you that. A Muslim lives 10% by Quran and 90% by Sunnah, all right? So a lot of Muslims will come to you and say, oh, Quran says this, Quran says that, and all that. And you think that that's really what they go by. No, not really. You know, they go by Sunnah. I guess the nearest thing that we as Christians would have to Sunnah would be, if I were to ask you, when does church start? What would you say? 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, you know, right? Sunday morning. Well, where does the Bible say that? It's one of those traditions. There's a reason for that. Now, let's take 5 assumptions held by Muslims, and these are just some basic things. First of all, they see man as the highest of God's creations, but not in God's image, all right? For you to say that you're in the image of God, you are associating something in the creation with Allah, and that is shirk, or blasphemy, for Muslims. You cannot associate anything with... That's one of those things you got to make. You can't make that mistake of being perceived as associating something in creation with God. All right. Man cannot be sure of his eternal destiny. Man is the highest of God's creations, but not in God's image. Even in the Quran, you have anthropomorphism, just like you have in the Bible. They call it the hand of God, the throne of God, and all that. But they generally don't do that. Now, I'm just going to give you just a little bit. I'm giving you a shortcut on what Islam is, because I really want to focus on the challenge of Islam, actually. Now, Muslims will use some of the same language that you do, but they mean something entirely different. Like, you know, one time I ran across a phrase in the Quran talking about Jesus, referred to him as the Word of God. I got all excited, you know? Well, they mean something entirely different by that. Here's the other one. Man cannot be sure of his eternal destiny. Therefore, we must work to improve our chances of entering into paradise. Islam is a works righteousness religion. Now, let me give you an Ellis axiom, all right? Islam, one way or the other, is derived from the religion of Cain. All works righteousness religion is derived from the religion of Cain. Right. All right? Here's Cain and Abel. Abel does a sacrifice. He's responding to God's grace. God's promise to bring salvation through the seed of the woman, right? So Abel comes along and gives sacrifices. God, here's my best. I'm responding to you, right? Cain, on the other hand, when he went and did his sacrifice, he was trying to appease God. He believed in the sacrifice. Got it? So because he had a works righteousness system, anybody who had a different one than his was a threat, especially if his was accepted. See? So Cain's thinking, well, God needs the sacrifice. You hear the theological fallacy there? God needs a sacrifice. He's got a choice of two. He takes Abel's and not mine, so I'll eliminate Abel's. So he'll have to take mine. So works righteousness religion always leads to injustice, war, bigotry, and a whole lot of other stuff. And to the extent that Christianity slips into works righteousness Christianityism, we behave exactly the same way. So there's a whole lot of Christianity in America that is functionally Muslim. Now, I go to the mosque all the time, right? And I talk to these guys. The mosques are loaded with disgruntled Baptists. Methodists and Presbyterians, Pentecostals, hello, Charismatics. Why? Because you see, the Christianity that they were exposed to was a works righteousness Christianityism, and Christianity does not make a very good works righteousness religion. It's got too much leeway. In Islam, everything is laid out for you exactly. You read the hadith, it'll tell you exactly what hand to use and what fingers to do when you blow your nose. I mean, it's all there. It's all laid out for you. Clear. So the Muslims, you see, they have to work to enter into paradise. And you never know. You know, they're the ones that came up with the scale idea, you know. Good deeds here, bad deeds there, right? Right? Whichever way it goes. Now, Muhammad recognized that was a serious problem. Because if anybody was honest and put a ledger sheet out there, take all your good thoughts and your bad thoughts, your good thoughts and good actions and put them on this side. Take all your bad thoughts and bad actions and put them on this side. Just one day, which way would it tilt? You know, right. Now, Muhammad said, oh, that's a problem. So he came up with a revelation. You know, just in time, God got this revelation, right? Oh, bingo, I got the new revelation. Here's the deal. One good deed weighs as much as 10 bad ones. Okay, all right. Take that. But be honest. Take all your good thoughts and good actions on one side, all your bad thoughts and bad actions on the other. I can almost guarantee that it'll still tilt the wrong way. If you were honest, you know. They feel that they do not need a savior because they are not sinners in a Christian sense. Muslims have a very inadequate view of sin. That's their Achilles heel, by the way. What happened to Adam in the garden? It was a slip. That's all it was. It only affected Adam. It didn't affect anybody else. See, with Muslims, we are all born Muslim. We are all born Muslim, and it's our environment that leads us astray. So we got to come back to the right path, you see. I heard one imam tell me, yeah, well, see, in Islam, we believe in human potential. We're not on welfare like you Christians. Oh, boy, that's deep, isn't it? All right, let me move on. Salvation comes through good works according to the teachings of the Quran, not through a personal relationship with God. There is no personal relationship with God in Islam. Allah is unknowable. He is unknowable. He is unknowable. Everybody ready? Yep. All right, finally, they believe that their ideology is a restatement of Allah's will for man, therefore it should permeate all of society. You see that? It should permeate all of society. Muslims have always believed that all of life must be Islamic. You know, doesn't that sound like worldview to you? All right. And then finally, Islam is founded on Sharia, which is Islamic law. Sharia. You'll hear me talk about Sharia a few other times. That's Islamic law, all right? Law. It's a religion of law. Now, they talk about Allah being gracious and all that, but it's a religion of law. All right. Now, that's just a little bit about Islam itself. Now, let's talk about the challenge of Islam. I can tell you about the demographics of the American thing, but we know we ain't got that kind of time. So let's skip down here to... It is ironic that at the turn of the century, Islam was in such a state of decline that they had a meeting. All the Muslim leaders in the world came together, the major ones came together, and they were discussing if Islam had a future. That was around 1900. And I'll show you a couple of things here. I was able to, now don't tell anybody I got this, but I was able to get this from some espionage kind of stuff. The resolutions of the 1974 International Conference of Islamic Organizations held in Mecca. And this is what they said. This is what they said back in 74. Now, 74, Islam wasn't doing so hot. But it's really come forth since then. Muslims organizations should be set up to resist missionary activity. Why should they resist missionary activity? What's wrong? What's the point? Because to them, Christianity and Western culture are one and the same. So when we take Baywatch, see, over to Bahrain, as far as they're concerned, Baywatch is Christian. You got it? All right. So they want to resist missionary activity. Islamic TV stations should be established. All Christian activity in Muslim countries should be stopped. This is what they said in 1974. And if you look at what's going on today, that's exactly what's happening. All right? Remember those missionaries in Afghanistan that were arrested? I had to intervene personally on behalf of a pastor, a Filipino pastor in Saudi Arabia who was ministering only to Filipino slaves. Now, okay, you got it? He wasn't ministering to Saudis, but he was arrested for preaching Christianity and sentenced to be hanged on Christmas Day. He had exhausted all of his appeals, and all we could do was fax and email and everything all over the place, trying to bring some pressure on the Saudi government, and they did. They finally relented and deported him. But it was rough, you know, and he was charged with preaching Christianity. Hospitals, schools, orphanages, universities, should all be controlled by Muslims. All right, this is what they said, and this is what is happening today. All Christian literature should be banned in Muslim countries, and the economic strength of the Muslim world should be utilized so that no financial support is given to any country whose missionary activities are carried on against Islam. So if some countries, say Nigeria, sends missionaries up to Chad, then as much as Nigeria might need the money, they'll just cut them off completely. This is what they said in those resolutions. These are some of their resolutions, all right? And we see some of those things going on today. Why? Because Islam is perceiving Christianity as an arm of the decadent West. All right. Now, let's look at five responses of Christians to Muslim status. Now, dhimmi is a Muslim word, protect, all right? If you are a Christian minority in a Muslim country, you are a dhimmi. You are under dhimmi status, all right? This is the way it works. The Muslims are obligated to protect you. But guess what? You got to pay through the nose for that protection. And if you don't pay, what happens? They clobber you. Doesn't that sound familiar somewhere? So what do the Christians do? They can either accept their dhimmi status, or they can convert to Islam. They can immigrate to the West, and you find a lot of... Do you know that 9 out of 10 Arabs in this country are Christians? You see these people coming over, you wonder, where are these people coming from? The Middle East and all that, they come. Why? Because they immigrate to the West. They get engaged in conflict. There are some Christians who do, such as in Sudan and Nigeria, in the Juba Mountains in Nigeria. I was talking to some Nigerian friends the other day. They said, yeah, they're working on this third cheek theology. That's what they call it. Third cheek theology. Turn the other one. That's it. Third one, you're going to get it. Now, I could have told them about... Maybe they should have talked about a fifth cheek theology, but that's a whole other issue. No, you didn't catch that one. Or they can try to start a Christian state, which is what they attempted to do in Lebanon, okay, with the Maronites, but now that's been gone. Now that's controlled. Lebanon is now pretty much controlled by the Syrians, okay, so that's a failure. So this is what's going on in the Middle East, and some terrible things that are happening. So we must think now, as Christians, we must think in terms of what affects the body of Christ. We must think about our brothers and sisters over in places like that. Now, let's look at this thing right here. Again, how do Muslims view things? How do Muslims view things? Let's look at the Western view of the relationship between life and religion and the Muslim view. Let's look at the Western view first of all. When we talk about life versus religion, how do we see it? How do we look at it? What's the relationship, all right? Now, in the West, we view it this way. We view life as the big rectangle, and we view religion as a small rectangle within it. That's the way we look at it. I'm not saying this is a Christian view, this is a Western view, all right? Now, how do the Muslims view it? How do the Muslims view this thing? Well, here it is. For them, guess what's the big rectangle? It's religion. And life is a small rectangle within it, or a small thing. It's a proper subset, if you want to put it in mathematical terms. That's how they look at it. And that makes for a radically different way of doing things. You see? Again, the Muslims have never given up. Well, only a few in the secular type Muslims in some parts in the West. But generally speaking, they see all of life as being Islamic. And how have we lost that in the West? I don't know. I know why. Because we were trying to deal with unbelieving philosophy and science and a whole lot of other things. All right. I'm going to take you through a quick thing on the World Challenge of Islam. We're going to look at the Muslim extremists. We're going to look at how they view things. How do they think? I'm going to try to get you into the head of some of these guys. Here are some of their ideologies. First of all, when Muslims approach any society, this is how they operate. This is how they're operating in this country. This is how they're operating in the UK. By the way, if you really want to understand the nature of Islamic advance in the West, if you want to know what America is going to look like in about 10 to 15 years regarding Islam, go to the UK. In London alone, I'm just talking about London. In London alone, over 400 churches have been converted to mosques. There are more Muslim bookstores in the UK than there are Christian ones. And if you will notice, and it's happening in this country, you will notice that in the British press, whenever they talk about Muhammad, they talk about the Prophet Muhammad. They don't say just say Muhammad. You start to see that here in this country. You know why? Because the Muslims are putting a great deal of pressure on people to be politically correct. So what happens when they come into a society, they boycott the existing institutions of health and they establish parallel institutions, especially in the areas of health, education, and welfare. Why do they do this? Because what they are trying to do is set up a parallel state, as it were. Now, for example, you ever wonder why the Palestinians and the Lebanese support Hezbollah and Hamas so much? Why? Because they've developed their own network of hospitals and schools and colleges and banks, and guess what? They usually provide excellent and cheap and efficient service to the community, better than the government can. That's why they get so much support, all right? And this is how they win the hearts of the people. This is one example of how they work. So they come in, they are trying to establish a Muslim state within the state. Because in Islam, you cannot be a true Muslim in the true sense of the word unless you are under Muslim authority. So states like Iran and others finance all of this stuff, and they raise money. They raise money. Now, one of the pillars of Islam is something called zakat. It's almsgiving. It's one of those, it's kind of like our tithe. It's like 2.5%. And all Muslims are required to do this. And so in some states and in some places, this money, this zakat money, has gone to support groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and all that. Now, how do they view authority? Islam is as much as a government as it is a religion. Remember how they view things? Therefore, all spheres of life must be under the authority of Allah. Now, for them, any government, whether it be Muslim or non-Muslim, that is not guided by Sharia, Islamic law, is judged to be illegitimate. Why do you think some of the Muslim leaders in the states over there are so scared of the Muslim fundamentalists? Because they regard them as un-Islamic. Therefore, they must be overthrown by any means necessary, whether it be by people power or terrorism. It doesn't matter. This is why the Shah of Iran was removed in 1979, because he wasn't guided by Sharia. This is why Anwar Sadat was assassinated in 1981. Why? Because his assassins saw his agreement, this Camp David agreement, as a surrender to Israel, and as such, according to them, he had left Islam. And do you know what the punishment for leaving Islam is? If you are a Muslim, and if you leave Islam for any reason, that is a what? That is a capital offense. And therefore, Sadat had left Islam, and therefore, had to be executed. All right? This is why the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan in 1996. Same thing. These guys are trying to establish, if you really want to understand what Islam really is in its essence, in its absolute essence, you look at the reign of the Taliban. Now, I know people get on my case about that, but that's true. They see Muslim governments, which cooperate with the West, as un-Islamic, hello, corrupt, oppressive, and subservient to the infidel imperialists, especially America. Therefore, they have no right to rule Muslims. And for them, authority over the Muslims is the exclusive prerogative of faithful Muslim believers. That's why these Muslim governments are kind of laying low about this coalition and all. Guys like Musharraf, we got to pray for guys like that. They're walking a tightrope because they got these elements within their own country that regard them as un-Islamic. And you regard somebody as un-Islamic, you're in serious shape. Now look at this. They view Western geopolitical and economic interests as new crusades against them. That's how they view it, as a crusade. So when you hear, you see a Muslim boy walking down the street with a boombox, listening to Mariah Carey or whoever, you understand? That's a part of the crusades of the West. What was that term we heard? Cultural imperialism, was that it? Yeah, that's it. Saddam Hussein, Colonel Gaddafi, and others, they whip up anti-Western and anti-Christian feelings, because of this, you see, because they say these people are carrying out crusades against us. Now, what do you think this means for the church in those countries? The church is seen as agents of the decadent imperialistic West. All right? There it is. So Christians in those countries are resented, not because of their faith, but because they are perceived to be agents of the West. Why is that such a bad thing? Because when looking at it from a Muslim point of view, Christianity looks like Christianityism, the Western man's religion. You got it? They would be regarded as Uncle Tom's, if I can use an African-American concept. By the way, if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, Uncle Tom was not an Uncle Tom, okay? It's funny how all ethnic groups have the same, like among African Americans, we talk about those of us who are black on the outside and white on the inside, we call them Oreos. You've heard the term? When I was talking to some Asian friends the other day, I said, y'all have the same phenomenon? I said, yeah. We call them bananas. The more things change, the more they stay the same, you know? Okay. Now, let me share this with you. Dr. Dudley Woodbury, professor at Fuller Seminary, sees this Islamic resurgence in response to three traumas that happened over the years in the Islamic world. First of all, the frustration and humiliation of years of colonialism, all right? This is particularly difficult for the Sunnis. Now, the Shiites, these are two major denominations. Sunnis and the Shiites are like the Catholics and the Protestants, you know, in terms of the big major divides. Actually, it's interesting. The Shiites, though they're the minority, they view government more like the Catholics, but the Sunnis are the majority. They view their leadership more like Protestants. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. But the Shiites have developed a theology of suffering where the Sunnis have not. And it's been a very difficult thing for them to deal with the legacy of colonialism. Now, another great trauma that arises that gives rise to this Muslim resurgence is the search for identity, which is a legacy of colonialism. What happened was that when they drew the lines, they carved up the Muslim world in terms of these jurisdictions. Saddam Hussein is right, actually. Kuwait was the 13th province. You know what I'm saying? They carved it up, and they threw some people together, and some people, and you know, their identity was shaped by these colonially drawn lines. They said, no, that's contrary to our identity. Again, you got to understand people's search for identity. The third one was the advance of Christian secularism, Christians, quote unquote, in the world at large. And this anti-Western feeling has serious repercussions for indigenous Christians in the countries. And again, anybody who's Christian in a Muslim country is perceived to be pro-Western and an enemy agent. Therefore, they're regarded as traitors and subversives. So those are the kind of things that we're looking at. I'm going to finish this. I'm going to get you into the heads of Muhammad Atta and his company in just a second here. Hence, the church in Muslim countries have suffered backlashes from stuff like the Gulf War, the Bosnian conflict, believe it or not, and the current war on terrorism. The church is suffering because of that. Now, one final thing I'll leave with you, and I think this is it. Why have these terrorists struck us so hard? There's so much I could deal with here, but let's just go on down here and I'll just leave you with this one. I think this is one you'll remember. I'm going to try to get you into the minds of these hijackers, okay? Let's look at Islamic terrorists, all right? But there's one other thing I want to show you that's very important in terms of our response, okay? First of all, why are they mad at us? Why are they mad at us? Islam is in the midst of a great resurgence, that's true. But the problem is the resurgence has revealed serious fractures in the global Islamic community. If you look at what's going on, I mean, the Islamic community in the world is on the verge of balkanization, as it were. It's on the verge of permanent damage. Muslims are fighting Muslims, even though they are in the midst of a great resurgence. But the fractures are defined by the ideologies of the various resistance movements. So the Moral Liberation Front, you know, they can't stand Hamas, even though they're both resisting something similar. Or they all suspect Ikhwan al-Muslimi, you know, whatever. So they're fighting each other. And why are they fighting each other? Because they are resisting something. What are they resisting? Most of these movements are fighting the power and influence of the un-Islamic West. So it is the presence of the West and its influence that's causing these resistance movements to come up. But these resistance movements are developing ideologies that are at war with each other. You got it? All right. Thus, the infidel West is seen as hindering their plans for a global application of Sharia. It is the goal of Islam to bring the whole world under Islamic law. So therefore, it is the West that's resisting this, and it's causing the fragmentation in the Islamic community. You know, they're ticked off about what happened to the Taliban now. So the question is, what is their ideology? Islamic fundamentalists adhere to a strict application of Sharia, remember, Islamic law. For them, any non-Islamic influence must be eliminated at all costs, especially if it threatens Islam. Now, that's what they'll tell you. They'll tell you, oh, we don't believe in holy war. We don't believe in jihad unless it threatens Islam. All you got to do is define it as threatening Islam, and then you got it. The power and influence of the West is seen as a serious threat to Islam. Therefore, what? Jihad is called for against the secular Christian West, and it is the duty of every Muslim to strike with the vengeance of Allah deep into the heart of the infidel. Now, I'm going to tell you something. There was a movie that was put out a number of years ago called Executive Decision. It is one of the best movies I've ever seen that illustrates this mentality. And it's about a plane hijacking, believe it or not. So what are their targets? America is seen as the pillar of the decadent West. The power of America is its economy. The strength of the American economy is what? The financial system and the vitality of its global trade, right? And the very symbol of Western American world domination was what? The World Trade Center. Therefore, what? It was the hub of all the anti-Islamic influence of the decadent Western globalization, and it was the sweet spot for a terrorist strike. It's just very logical. Very logical. And therefore, the World Trade Center was struck. And that's why they hit it on the day they hit it. As a matter of fact, if you look at, if you take the numbers in Arabic, 9, 1, 1, and 1 in Arabic, and you read it from right to left, you know what it spells? Allah. And Tuesday is the day when Muslims reserve to execute people and so forth and so on. It's very interesting. I don't know if they knew this, but it's not going to stop at the World Trade Center. Many other targets are going to be attacked before it's over. Now, this is the final thing I want to leave with you in terms of a Christian response. What do we do? There's so much more that I could say, but let's just look at this real quick. Why are we so powerless? Why are we so impotent in light of all of this stuff? It's because we have an inadequate theology. I didn't say we had an inadequate Bible. We have an inadequate theology. Now let's look at the issue is an issue of righteousness and unrighteousness. Both of these are relational and covenantal terms. What is righteousness anyway? Righteousness merely means to do right by the other party in the covenant. Ooh, that's it. God always does right by us, therefore we must what? Always do right by him. Now watch this. Unrighteousness is what? A failure to do right by the other party in the covenant. Very simple terms. Where do we start? This is where we start, with a reevaluation of our understanding of righteousness and unrighteousness. Where am I coming from? You'll find out in a minute. Okay, let's talk about unrighteousness first of all. Unrighteousness has four dimensions to it. First of all, there's, and in Free at Last I have a discussion of this, but it's not quite as developed as this here. This is for the next book, all right? Free at Last 2, which I'm working on. This is one dimension. Ungodliness happens when a person sins and suffers his or her own consequences, right? I put a gun to my head, fully loaded gun, I pull the trigger, I suffer the consequence. Now, here's another dimension of unrighteousness. It's oppression. Oppression happens when a person sins and forces others to suffer the consequences. Oh. Say, I don't like people with green sweaters. Anybody here got a green sweater on? Whatever. So I pick up a gun and I start shooting people with green sweaters. I'm the one with the problem, but the person with the green sweater is the one in the pig's position, remember? Okay, or another way of looking at it is when a person tries to force his or her own sin on others. Okay, those are two dimensions of unrighteousness. Now the other two are what? The individual dimension, that is, face-to-face intentional sin, and the institutional dimension of unrighteousness, which is sin that is woven into the structure and societal fabric, okay? It is woven into the structure and social fabric of the society. It is so insidious that it does not need the intention or consciousness of the individual to have its devastating effects. I can say, oh, I have no problem against Native Americans. Some of my best friends. But I belong to a country club that excludes them. You got it? I don't have to feel that way, but if I belong to a society that does this for me, where does that put me? You got it? Four dimensions. Four dimensions, you got four manifestations, okay? Four manifestations according to the window of unrighteousness, right? Now, if we take this thing, the upper two panes would be ungodliness. The lower two panes would be oppression. The left two panes would be what? The individual dimension. And the right two panes would be the institutional dimension. Now, let me ask you this question. We as evangelical, Bible-believing, born-again, fire-baptized, Holy Ghost, whatever, Christians, full gospel, you know. When we talk about unrighteousness, what do we tend to focus on? There it is, the individual, right? So that's our problem. Our problem is we have an inadequate understanding of unrighteousness. And so we leave these other three pains to other people. We don't say anything about this. We don't say anything about the oppression dimension. We don't say anything about the institutional dimension. Why? Because we're in the dominant culture, most of us. And when you're in the dominant culture, it has nothing to do with skin color. It just has to do with power. You know, over in Kenya, You know, I got a friend who I used to argue with all the time. I couldn't understand why we used to argue so badly. I said, why does she think so white? You know? And it turned out that she's from the Kikuyu tribe, which is the dominant tribe in Kenya. She's thinking as a dominant person. I was thinking as a subdominant person. I didn't realize it until I went to Kenya to find out. I explained it to her. She said, oh, okay. And we get along just fine now, see? But if we're in the dominant culture, here's an axiom, an Ellis axiom. If you're in the dominant culture, the system, however you want to define the system, always delivers its best to you. If you're in the subdominant culture, the system will not deliver nearly as much. So if you're in the dominant culture, the system is just fine. So oppression is not going to be an issue for you. Neither is, right? So what has happened is that we have left the other three panes of the window to Louis Farrakhan and Osama bin Laden and all those other guys, right? Doesn't the Bible deal with all four panes? Of course it does. But if we don't see it, we got a hermeneutical problem. How many of you have blamed Abraham for telling the state troopers that Sarah was his sister? How many of you have gotten mad at Abraham? I know I have. But check it out. Did God get mad at Abraham? No. He got mad at somebody. He almost whacked somebody because of it, right? He didn't get mad at Abraham. Who did he get mad at? He got mad at Pharaoh. Why? Because it was Pharaoh that set up the institutional system that forced Abraham to make a choice between what relationship he's going to reveal, right? He got it? It was Pharaoh who put him in that position. There's an example of institutional oppression. And Abraham was responding to it the best way he can. But we often blame the victim because of our hermeneutical problems. We don't see it in the scripture. It's all there. All right. Righteousness has a similar setup. Godliness, what? Doing right by God. Devotion and piety. Did you have your quiet times this morning? Did you say grace before you ate? Justice. What's justice? Doing right by your fellow human beings. Justice is a biblical term, is derived from two concepts, liberation and empowerment, and that's right out of the Jubilee concept. Liberation and empowerment, there it is. All debts are canceled, liberation. Everybody's to be restored to his own property, empowerment. You got it? Okay, two other dimensions. The personal dimension, doing right on a one-on-one basis. The social dimension, doing right corporately as a society. Guess what, there's a window, right? You know me, I like windows. There's a window of righteousness, all right? Top two panes, godliness. Bottom two panes, justice. Left two panes, personal. Right two panes, what? Social. And, of course, we as evangelical, Bible-believing, fundamental, whatever, fire baptized, right? Which one do we tend to limit our understanding to? There it is, personal godliness, and that's it. And we leave these others. There are people who are clamoring for these things. By the way, we got to be on all four of those panes because there are some people who are going to start searching for God here. They don't see him here. What's going to happen? Jesus says, let your light so what? So that others may see your and glorify your Father in heaven. When you read in the Old Testament, when it talks about if you do thus and so, your light will shine brighter than the noonday sun. What is God talking about? He's talking about social justice. That's what he's talking about. That's the visible stuff. Now, the problem is, the reason we can't answer this stuff, this is the unanswered issue, is because we have consigned ourselves to one-fourth. Okay, this is the window of righteousness. Consider that the gospel. We have neglected three-fourths of the gospel. And even those of us who say we are full gospel, we are at best one-fourth gospel. That's the reduced gospel right there. Window of unrighteousness, think of that as a great commission. We have abandoned three-fourths of it. And until we go through a reformation and rediscover all four panes in both windows, we're going to be in serious trouble. So that, brothers and sisters, is what I consider some of the unanswered. Of course, we leave those other three panes to whoever, right? Just leave it at that. Anyway, I'm through. I'm sorry I took so long. I'm sorry I went over time a little bit. Amen.
This is a copyrighted program of Strategic Christian Services, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Strategic Christian Services offers a wide variety of other educational materials and training schools designed to help you live life to its fullest. For more information on our products and services, please call us at 1-800-700-0605. Join us online at www.gostrategic.org or write to us at Post Office Box 2709, Santa Rosa, California, 95405.